Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Hey everyone, it's Michelle Williams, and I love being able to share my story with you on my podcast, Checking In with Michelle Williams, where my guests and I, we get real as we share the ups and downs of our mental health journeys, and I'd love for you to join me. Hey, it's going to be your church and your turn up. So listen to Checking In with Michelle Williams every Tuesday, a part of the Black Effect on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Pharrell on the bench in the biggest way possible, hanging out, a bad seed, a broken egg, a bad apple with a bad attitude, hanging around a bunch of bad actors, bad taste, bad luck, bad dude, bad breath, bad attention, bad vibes. So I was reading this New York Times article from way back in the day. This was in January of 2010, so a decade ago, and it was out of Harlemville, New York, and it was about Frank Serpico. Everybody remembers the celebrated 1973 film Serpico. Remember the cop? He dressed up like a bum, a butcher, a rabbi, and he would catch the bad guys. His off-duty look was never vintage cop either. He had the bushy beard rocking and the beads, and he was like a hippie. And he was the man whose long and loud complaining about widespread corruption in the New York Police Department made him a pariah on the force. He was shot in the face during a 71 drug bust while screaming for backup from his fellow officers. They had failed to call for an ambulance because nobody liked him. The undaunted whistleblower, whose testimony was the centerpiece of this huge commission hearing, which sparked the biggest shakeup in the history of the NYPD. Then you go up to 2010, and he was still bearded, and he was a flamboyant dresser. At that time, he was 73, he'd be 83 now. But he used to chase down and collar perps, and he did everything, this guy. He carried his detective shield. He was awarded, as he left the department, on a disability pension, and his licensed revolver, which he took to a target practice on his 50-acre property not far from Columbia County. He still carries bullet fragments lodged below his brain from his drug shooting. He's deaf in his left ear and has nerve damage in his left leg. All that was in the movie when he saw the doctor at the end after his surgery, and the doctor said, "You're going to have brain damage. You're going to have fragments in your brain. It's going to be there forever. You're going to be deaf in your ear. You're going to have nerve damage in your legs." And they show him leaving the hospital, and there's a cop car waiting for him, and he gets in it, but he's got a cane and he's limping, and his one and only cop friend helped him get in the cop car. He didn't trust any cops at that point, but Pacino played him. Al Pacino was unbelievable. He won his first Golden Globe Award for his star turn in the film. The movie, along with news reports and the best-selling biography of the same name, seared the public memory with painful images of the honest cop bleeding in a squad car rushed to the hospital, where after months of rehab, he received cards telling him to rot in hell, die, you're scum, hope you have a slow death, and everything else. And then at the end of the movie, Serpico, of course, the last scene, basically, he took his fluffy sheepdog, Alfie, and boarded a ship to Europe, and it said at the end that he was, quote, now living somewhere in Switzerland, end quote. So that was true at the time. He had traveled abroad. Serpico returned to the U.S. around 80, lived as a nomad out of a camper, and then he settled down 2 hours north of New York City in the woods in a cabin along the Hudson River. And then he had even spoke out after the brutal beatings of Abner Louema in a Brooklyn station house. But he doesn't like getting into the whole cop thing anymore. But Peter Moss wrote a biography that sold 3 million copies, and Serpico got a bunch of royalties from that, so he was living comfortably after that. He made a bunch of money, basically. The memoir begins with the same awful scene as the film when he got shot in the face during a heroin drug bust in Williamsburg, Brooklyn in February of 71. And the title was Before I Go. And Serpico said it's the rest of the story. It's more personal. I used to think, how can I write my life story? I'm still living it. And I'm getting close to the line, so I better get busy. But he said he wandered around Europe and North America. He wanted to find his life. He had gone through a near-death experience, and that gives you an insight into how fleeting life is, and that's important. He was talking about being a vegan and eating organic food, cooking on a wood-burning stove that heats the cabin, no TV, no internet. He said, that's my life now, the woods, nature, solitude. He relies on Chinese medicine, herbs, shiatsu, practices meditation, the Japanese Zen flute, African drumming and dance, ballroom tango swing, long walks. He rescues wounded animals, raises chickens and guinea hens, had a girlfriend, a French chick. She was a school teacher, but none of it gets rid of the demons that he had. He said he had nightmares. I open a door a little bit and it just explodes in my face, or I'm in a jam and I call the police, and then guess who shows up? My old cop buddies who hated his guts. So he grew up in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. And when he was a kid, he loved the cops. He loved detective stories on the radio and dreamed of wearing a cop uniform. And he had some worldliness in him. He visited Italy as a kid, traveled abroad with the army after enlisting at 18. He joined the NYPD in 59, and he pursued big game. He said he had partners and bosses who resented his hippie looks and his zealousness to make arrests, even while off duty or on the turf of other officers. His intrigues with the ballet and opera rubbed against the conservative culture of the cops and the station house. He lived a bohemian life in this small apartment on Perry Street in the West Village. I know where that is. And they called him Paco, and he hid his police badge when he was off duty. Serpico was appalled at the payoffs, free meals, as well as big, blatant bribes from criminals, gamblers, numbers men, and ordinary merchants who he saw with all these beat cops on the take and everything else. He was working in Brooklyn's 81st precinct back in the day, and eventually would later work vice and racketeering. And then he refused to accept all the grease and became despised for it both inside and outside the NYPD. In 1967, Serpico began telling what he knew to high-ranking officials at police headquarters and City Hall. He presented names, places, dates, and other info, but no action was ever taken. And just like in a movie, he and one of his friends on the force, he had very few, the guy's name was David Dirk. He was a guy that went to Amherst College and became an officer in 63 after quitting law school. They ended up hooking up with this reporter from the New York Times. And they ran a front page story by David Burnham on April 25th, 1970. And Serpico testified that the atmosphere does not yet exist in which an honest police officer can act without fear of ridicule or reprisal from fellow officers. So they all turned on him. The commission carried out the most extensive investigation of cop wrongdoing in the city's history and exposed a pattern of entrenched corruption and cover-up that helped usher in reform. Serpico said that nothing ever changed. He said the department still to this day does not acknowledge its internal problems because the leadership's top priority is to avoid scandal, and that's always been the case. He said, I hear from police officers all the time. They contact me. An honest cop still can't find a place to go and complain without fear of recrimination. The blue wall will always be there because the system supports it. So he never went to the city very often, but he still left part of himself in those station houses. A few years ago, he showed up at a John Jay College of Criminal Justice situation in Manhattan to confront Pat Murphy, the police commissioner at the time of the shooting, who was in the audience. And he said, I've been carrying a bullet around in my head for 35 years, and I hold you responsible, Serpico recalled telling Murphy, who never responded. He eventually got a Medal of Honor that he was awarded, the department's highest commendation, and he tossed it in a drawer. And he said, they never even had a ceremony for me of the honorary promotion. They handed it over to me, like over the counter with the Medal of Honor, like a pack of cigarettes, he said. So when he lived in Europe, he bought a farm in the Netherlands, married this Dutch chick, had two kids. She died of cancer. Her parents took custody of the children, and Serpico sold the farm, moved back to the United States. And he wandered the continent from Mexico to Canada in his camper. So in like 1980, he had a lover and they had a son, and she brought a paternity suit against him. He said he was deceived and entrapped by the woman. And then they had this huge court battle to avoid child custody. He did not raise the son and then barely ever had contact with him over the years. So the New York Times did this long interview with him, and he always met him in different places. He would never reveal exactly where he lived. He'd show up in different outfits and hats. One day he was a sheep herder, the next day a prospector, then he was a monk. He wears earrings in his ears and a magnifying glass around his neck for fine print, and he was just a freak. But he knew everything. He knew Italian, Spanish, German, Dutch, Arabic, Russian. And he would always quote from Dante's Inferno. He'd pull out a harmonica and play Danny Boy. You can't even make this stuff up. He said he became an actor. He said, my acting career began on the streets of New York. When I was a cop, I played many impressive roles, from derelict to doctors, and my life often depended on my performance. He used to tell his former cop colleagues that he was writing a book, but only as a bluff. He said, I'm going to name names, and if anything happens to me, I got it all written down right here. And he said he never really wrote anything. He would use it to bluff everybody and freak them out and scare them. Serpico wrote about his life in longhand at the cabin, and then he would go to the library and type with two fingers the story, and he would tell about all the arrests he made. And then he would talk about the Williamsburg drug bust, his bleeding body cradled by an elderly tenant who called for assistance when the cops he was with would not help him. The real Serpico said he never watched the movie, and then the New York Times got him to watch it. And they watched it on this laptop, and in the scene where he was rushed to the Greenpoint Hospital when he was bleeding to death, he couldn't even watch it. He was unable to watch it. It was too painful for him. And then during the movie, he provided running commentary. So in the movie, they show the cop, the commissioner, handing him a gold detective shield when he's in the hospital bed, lying there, recovering. But he said that never happened. He said that wasn't real. He got it at the police headquarters from a clerk over the desk. So anyway, the Times wrote the piece. This guy, Corey Kilgannon, I thought it was really cool. It was tripped out reading about the real guy, because I was watching this movie again, and I've seen it many times over the years and never really appreciated it or paid much attention to it. I kind of was like, oh, here's this hippie movie with Pacino as a narc cop going against all of the other cops and turning them in. I was always kind of bored with it, but the other day I watched it and intently got into it. From start to finish, I was blown away at, through the years, what I had missed. I mean, this is one of the great movies of all time. It really was. And I was watching it and I came to appreciate it like never before. And I was like, this is unbelievable. I was watching this flick and I'm going, what is happening here? How did I miss all this throughout the years? I just thought, man, this is really cool. And I thought it was really well done. And I had never really known about the fact that they had filmed the entire thing in New York City. Can you imagine back in the day they're doing this in the early 70s and banging out this movie on the streets of New York City?
Are you ready for the nation's first and only free 24-hour network dedicated to you, the betting and fantasy sports enthusiast? SportsGrid will provide you with real-time content, statistics, and gaming intelligence unlike anything you've ever seen before. Located both in the heart of New York City and inside the FanDuel Sportsbook at the Meadowlands, SportsGrid is live 18 hours a day, here to serve you, the fanatic. This is SportsGrid. Get on the grid.
Hey everyone, it's Michelle Williams, and I love being able to share my story with you on my podcast, Checking In with Michelle Williams, where my guests and I get real as we share the ups and downs of our mental health journeys, and I'd love for you to join me. I'm still on my own journey, but I want to be transparent with you because as I was posting all the highlights of my life on social media, I was breaking down. And too many people fall victim to the picture-perfect image of the high life, so I created a space to discuss the good and the bad. We can laugh, man. We gonna learn, and most of all, I hope to inspire you to go on this journey with me to better mental health. This is gonna be your church, your turn-up, and everything in between. So join me on my podcast, Checking In with Michelle Williams, a safe space for every kind of person. Listen to Checking In with Michelle Williams every Tuesday, a part of the Black Effect on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And there were so many kick-ass scenes. They were jumping from building to building, sliding down stairs and running through apartment buildings and chasing bad guys and drug busts and beating up drug dealers. And he was wearing all of his disguises and playing these roles. And then he was dealing with the brass that he was narking on, all the corruption and cops on the take and getting paid and how much money. And they showed him everywhere he went. These cops would frisk him and they always thought he was wearing a wire. And he was just so crazy and so rogue and so ballsy. I was just blown away watching it again and actually getting into it, where I really appreciate it this time around. I think this is really kick ass. And I was getting into it. I was just absolutely thrown for a loop when I actually delved into it hard and watched it with an intent of what is this movie that I have missed through all these years and never fully grasped or thought was anything more than just another Pacino movie. By the time I was done watching this movie, I actually thought it may have been, frankly, one of the best movies he's ever done in his career. And Pacino's done a million movies. I mean, think about this guy's career. It is so unbelievable. It's not even funny. The Godfather in 72, Godfather 2, Scarface was in 83. Obviously, my favorite movie of all time that Pacino did was Scarface. It was just so unbelievable. I imitated him all the time. Like, another leg, huh? What do you think I am, a baggage handler? Anyway, so he did Scent of a Woman. He did Heat with De Niro and Val Kilmer in 95. Dog Day Afternoon in 75. That was absolutely badass. Obviously, Serpico was 73. Carlito's Way was 93. I thought that was a great movie. Donnie Brasco was 1997. And then he just kept making more and more. Godfather 3 in 90, The Devil's Advocate in 97. And then The Irishman last year, 2019, he was great in that. He played Jimmy Hoffa in that movie. De Niro was in it as Frank, the Irishman, Sheeran, and Pesci was in it, and Keitel. And I thought The Irishman was awesome. It was up for awards. It didn't really get any in the Academy Awards, but I thought it was a great flick. You know, my travel agent and my ass doctor, his daughter was in the movie. He played De Niro's daughter in the beginning of the movie. It was like a 3.5-hour movie. In the beginning of the movie, like the first 90 minutes of the movie, the girl was real young, a little girl, and she experienced all the stuff that her dad was doing, and he was crazy going around beating people up and everything else. And so she was in the movie, so we got to go see the movie. And I thought Pacino was great in it as Hoffa. I mean, think about it. He was in The Insider in 99, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That was last year. Glengarry Glen Ross in 92. Righteous Kill with De Niro in 2008. Any Given Sunday. Sports fans love that movie. With Jamie Foxx, Cameron Diaz, Oliver Stone, of course. Dennis Quaid was in it. He did Sea of Love in 89, Insomnia, I remember that flick, with Robin Williams, and Justice for All in 79, The Panic in Needle Park, Frankie and Johnny, you remember that flick, Jack and Jill in 2011, Ocean's 13, Danny Collins, he was in 88 Minutes, I mean, this guy never stopped making movies, The Recruit, with Colin Farrell, Dick Tracy in 1990, You Don't Know Jack, Cruising in 1980, Stand Up Guys in 2012, Merchant of Venice, can you even imagine? Two for the Money, I love that flick in 2005, with Matthew McConaughey, Bobby Deerfield back in 77, Author in 82, Manglehorn, of all things, in 2014. Scarecrow was another one with Gene Hackman back in 73, same year as Serpico. Looking for Richard, remember that, 96? Simone, I mean, it is unbelievable. The Humbling in 2014. City Hall, 96. Zhili in 2003, The Son of No One in 2011, People I Know, Phil Spector he played, Chinese Coffee in 2000, Misconduct 2016, Revolution. I mean, it just goes on and on. The Local, Stigmatic, Two Bits. What movie didn't this guy do? Honest to God. He won a Best Actor Oscar and a Golden Globe for Scent of a Woman, if you remember. Way back, he gained notice for his lead role as a heroin addict in The Panic in Needle Park in 1971. But it was his role as Michael Corleone in Coppola's The Godfather in 72. That was when he received his first Oscar nomination. A lot of people think his portrayal of Corleone is one of the greatest performances in movie history. He did get the nomination for the Academy Award for Serpico in 73. People actually loved him as Jack Kevorkian in You Don't Know Jack, I was mentioning before. The guy's done everything, movies, TV. He was born in East Harlem neighborhood in New York City in April of 1940. His parents got divorced. He moved with his mother to the Bronx and lived with her parents, who were Italian immigrants from Sicily. They say he began smoking and drinking at age 9 and smoked dope casually at age 13. But eventually got over that and abstained from hard drugs. When some of his closest friends died from drug abuse at young ages. When he was a kid, he was constantly getting in fights and everybody thought he was a troublemaker when he was in school. Eventually, in 62, his mom died when she was 43. And then a year later, his grandpa died. And that was a point where he said it was the lowest part of his life. He was 22 and everyone that was important in his life was dead, and then he went into a tailspin. Now he's in this Amazon video series called Hunters, where he plays this Nazi hunter. People don't know, he never married. He's got 3 kids. His oldest is a chick. She was born in 89. And he's got twins, a son and a daughter that were born in 2001. With actress Beverly D'Angelo, and he had a relationship with her from the late 90s to 2003. I think he's been a great actor, but I really took a different approach to how brilliant he is by watching that Serpico and really admiring what he was doing back then. That is just crazy stuff. You gotta watch it yourself to appreciate it. He was a badass in that movie. I thought he played Serpico perfectly. And it's crazy what he went through as that cop and how everybody hated his guts and he had literally one or two friends at all. That was it. And he was able to basically bring the NYPD to its knees with all their corruption. I really dug it. It was fun watching it. And I like a lot of his movies. He's been fantastic and a brilliant career. You got to respect Al Pacino, no doubt about it. But there's really nobody that doesn't love Scarface, the 83 American crime film directed by Brian De Palma and written by Oliver Stone. Tells the story of the Cuban refugee played by Pacino, Tony Montana, who arrives in the 80s to Miami with nothing and rises to become this huge, powerful drug kingpin. So I thought it was funny because the movie was supposed to be in Miami, but the mansion that they shot it in was in Santa Barbara, California. And it was built in 1906. Back in the day, it cost him $25 million to make that movie. I always loved Stephen Bauer's role as Manny Ribera in the movie. Tony's best friend. He was kick-ass, and he was always womanizing. It was really about the real Scarface, Al Capone. Back in the day, while working at a bar in Brooklyn, Capone insulted a female customer. And he got cut in the face and it required 80 stitches. They said that Pacino insisted on taking the lead role as Montana, that De Niro had turned it down. And they said Pacino worked with experts in knife combat, trainers, and even Roberto Duran, the boxer, to attain the body type that he wanted for the role. Pacino always said that Duran inspired him as the character because he had a certain lion in him. Remember in the movie, you remind me of a tiger. Originally, De Palma didn't want Michelle Pfeiffer. He wanted Glenn Close in the movie. They had also considered Gina Davis, Carrie Fisher, Kelly McGillis, Sharon Stone, and Sigourney Weaver for the role. But Pfeiffer got it. They say because it was supposed to be in Miami, but they actually shot most of it in Los Angeles. And all the people in Miami thought it was going to deter tourism because of the depiction of the drugs and gangsters in Miami. It took them 24 weeks to shoot the movie. Originally, they gave the movie an X rating in America because of the extreme violence, strong language, and hard drug use. And that was kind of a rating for pornography at the time. And they were really tripping about the scene early in the movie when one of Montana's associates, Angel, is dismembered with a chainsaw. Remember that scene in the movie? That drove people crazy. When it was first released in theaters in December of 83, the winner of the weekend when it came out was Sudden Impact, which made $9.6 million, and Scarface earned $4.5 million. That's crazy considering what these movies make today. Roger Ebert, the great film critic, gave it 4 stars out of 4 in his 83 review. He later added it to his great movies list. Pacino was nominated for a Golden Globe. Bauer was nominated for a Golden Globe. I mean, I just thought that film was kick-ass. What person on the face of the earth didn't like Scarface? I still love it when I see it. I've only watched it about 50 times. So there you have it. A big day of Serpico and going down Al Pacino's career like memory lane. I just thought he made tons of great flicks, and I just appreciated him a lot after I watched that flick, and I can't get enough of that one after I saw it. And just thinking about all these other great movies he made, it was just kind of badass to think about all the stuff he's done in his career. Guy's a fantastic actor. You can't even deny it.
Want to light the lamp on DraftKings and FanDuel this NHL DFS season? Then join DailyRoto.com and learn from the best daily fantasy sports players. Get updated fantasy hockey projections for NHL DFS, line combinations, and build stacks for tournaments in the DailyRoto NHL DFS lineup optimizer. If you are playing daily fantasy hockey without using DailyRoto, you are doing it wrong. Enter the promo code ACTION for a 10% discount. That's promo code ACTION for a 10% discount.
Have you written a book and need some insight into what comes next?
Or are you passionate about cooking and want to know how to make it your career?
Or maybe you just want to hear insider stories about the entertainment industry. Either way, we've got you covered with the Two Guys from Hollywood podcast. I'm Alan Nevins, a literary agent and talent manager.
And I'm Joey Santos, a columnist and celebrity chef. And on our podcast, Two Guys from Hollywood, we bring our expertise to the table with, of course, delicious cocktails and all kinds of recipes for you to try at home.
So grab a drink and join us. We've got a wide range of celebrity guests and Hollywood insiders to discuss pop culture, publishing, and entertainment. And we'll provide you with an unfiltered and sometimes brutally honest show about Hollywood.
As we like to say, we don't dish, we serve.
Listen and follow Two Guys from Hollywood on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll talk at you soon.
So since there's no sports on and everybody's jonesing and they got nothing to watch, I typically revert to Pharrell Plan B, which is binge watching Netflix. And I try to find shows that I can watch a multitude of episodes and determine if I like them or not. Mostly, I look for violent shows. I like violence. I like action. I like people getting hurt. I like crime. I like bad guys. I like hooligans. And I was able to find a hooligan show. I've mentioned it before on Sports Grid, and it's Puerta 7. It's about an Argentinian soccer club. They have a massive problem with the mob and hooligans. What happens is this soccer club in Argentina is run by all of these gangsters. They're from a neighborhood, and they rule the streets, and they have found their way inside the football club, which is run by a rich family. And the father and son run the team, but they hire this chick whose grandfather used to own the club back in the day. And she never really had anything to do with it. She's this lesbian chick that's got a hot lover, and she's kicking hot herself. I'm kind of digging both of them, to be honest with you. And they hire her and bring her back as she grew up as a child, loving the club, and her grandpa owned it. And so they bring her out of her job. She's like a community activist and a teacher. And they convince her to come back to the soccer club and be in charge of security. So the story goes that the chick comes in and starts changing everything, like the entrances to the old decrepit stadium that they play in. It's like a dump, but the fans go there and they get really rowdy and they go in the bleachers and they control the stadium and they don't pay for tickets and they get hammered. They drink and they scream and they shout obscenities and they basically control the place and the crowd. And everybody's afraid of them. So they bring in this chick and she changes everything. She fires all the people that are the head of security who've been letting these hooligans do whatever they want for years. And they get away with everything. They never get in trouble for anything. And at the beginning of the show, the head of the mob, this guy Lomito, is at the game and he is in charge. He's the boss. He's the head of the crime family in the town in Argentina and everyone's afraid of him. And when he walks into the stadium, they all follow him in, all the hooligans, and they're behind him and all of his soldiers. They all go in with him and they watch the games and they cheer on their favorite team. And then in the first episode, he gets shanked. Some guy comes up from behind in the middle of the game when there's a goal going on and all the fans are cheering and they're excited that they've scored. Nobody sees him. And this guy cranks him with a knife like 5 times in his back. And he's laying there bleeding to death. Somehow they get him to the hospital and all of his soldiers chase the guy that stabbed him and they chase him through the streets of Argentina. The guy's running forever and he's going through alleys and jumping over fences and running through buildings and going up and down staircases, and they finally catch him and they capture him. And the first thing they do to him on the street when they get him is they shoot him in his legs with a bunch of bullets so he can't walk at all. He's rendered cripple. Then they take him to a warehouse and they hold him hostage there and beat him to a pulp over several days, trying to find out who hired him to do the hit on the crime boss. And they beat him to death almost, and they knock all his teeth out and they bash his eyes. His whole face looks like a tomato crushed, and he's bleeding from every orifice, and he still won't leak who hired him to kill the head of the mob. And so in the end, they just figure he's a waste of time and space, and they blow his head off. At this point, after one episode, I am hooked. I like the fact that they had massive amounts of violence in the first episode, a shanking, the multiple stabbings, the shootings, and the chases, and then trying to squeeze the guy for information. He won't talk, so they blow his head off. I thought it was a great way to start the show. The other thing that's going on in this show, besides the chick that they hire to clean things up at the football club, she's changing cameras and ticket policies and turnstiles and making more cops get hired to patrol the stadium because there's no real security at the games through the last several years and everything's been happening there, people getting stabbed and all the drunks and hooligans. So she hires all these cops. She hires this old cop. He was a cop back in the day in the town, and he was a renegade cop, and he was handling his business with violence, and he would just catch the bad guys and beat them to a pulp, which I'm in favor of. She gets him to come out of retirement and work for her, and he's now in charge of the stadium security. And then there's this kid who kind of has a story going on in his own right. What happens to this kid is his dad, and then this guy gets beat up by these twins who rob him, beat him, and take his truck and steal his business. So his son has to be the head of the family. He's just a young kid. He's 18 years old, and he's working in a pizza shop. And they go to this restaurant to drop off some money to the mob head, the guy that got stabbed, the head of the crime and hooligan family that runs the Argentinian neighborhoods. He's in there eating his big meal with his minions and his little soldiers. His two right-hand men are the two lead guys in the movie that play along with his crime boss, Lomito. And then what happens is they're eating and having all their pizza and pasta and wine. And some guy comes in on a motorcycle that had been following around the good kid and his friend on their little moped, followed him to the restaurant, and he walked in to kill the mob boss. So now this is the second time we've seen the mob boss have an attempt on his life. And the guy walks in with his helmet on the motorcycle and pulls out a giant gun from behind his belt. And as he's walking up to the table to shoot the mob boss in the head, the good kid that everybody feels sorry for with the dad that's been beat up, that has the crappy job at the pizza shop. He grabs a pole in the restaurant and bashes the guy in the head that's going to kill the mob boss. So, in essence, the good kid saved the mob boss's life. And they all take notice of that fact because he has saved the day. And everyone's grateful and they're like, you saved his life. What a great kid you are. Thank you. Then it doesn't end there. They go about their business. The kid goes on his way. They go on their way. Everything's fine. But then the mob boss sends one of his little soldiers to give the kid a bunch of money for saving the mob boss's life. So they go to the pizza store where he works, and they give him a stack of money in an envelope, and his boss sees it happen. So the boss fires the kid. Meanwhile, I guess it didn't matter because he hated him anyway. And secondly, he had an envelope full of money to live on. So at that moment, when he lost his job, the soldier for the mob boss said, hey, why don't you come work for me? You could be my driver. So now this kid gets a job working for the mob, driving one of the soldiers around who's basically a hitman for the mob head. And now he's his driver. He drives him around town in a Volkswagen, kind of souped up one. And now he's driving around this gangster as he's picking up money, doing drug runs and doing all kinds of hits on people and everything else. Meanwhile, this is like the nicest kid in the world. Kid that takes care of his dad, and he's loving and kind and, you know, does all the right things, never done anything wrong in his life. But meanwhile, he saved the mob boss's life, and now he's driving for the mob boss's hitmen. So it's kind of kick-ass at this point. And now the chick that's running the security for the football club is giving the head of the mob the business because he has a $40,000 bill at the football club for years of abuse of booze and food that he never pays a tab and demands that they feed him and get him drunk, or he'll kill them. So all the workers at the football club are afraid of him. Lomito. His name is Lomito, and he's the head of the crime family, and everyone is scared to death of him. He cuts deals with drug dealers and murderers to use parts of the city to sell their drugs in, and he gets a massive cut from where they sell the drugs. So he's in on everything. He's got money coming in from all avenues. Meanwhile, he lives in a gigantic mansion in town. He's the only guy with money, and he also represents soccer players. So he's recruiting kids to play for the football club, and he gets the best player from the area to play for him, and he lives with the family. Meanwhile, that guy's a superstar athlete, and the team won't play him. They won't start him on the team, but he's living with the mob boss, and he's trying to tap the mob boss's hot daughter. He's got like a hot daughter that's good to go, and the soccer player wants to have sex with her, which is also kick-ass. And there's all these scenes of temptation, and the mob boss warns him, if you do anything to my daughter, I'll cut your head off, which is an awesome way of letting him know that he means business. So things start getting sticky, and the mob boss tells his guys to go into the neighborhood where the top chick's from, and her lesbian friend, they built this giant wall mural with all the kids in the neighborhood because she used to be a teacher with all the kids, and she helped in the community, and she helped all the kids stay safe and do fun things and get their education and do the right thing when all around them is all this crime and mob stuff and drugs and bad people. So they painted this giant mural about happiness and love and holding hands and joyous type things. And then the mob boss said, if you want to mess with me and make me pay a $40,000 bill, watch this. So he sent his hooligans down there and they burned it down and then threatened the chick. So in turn, she wasn't swayed. She drove right over to him at their little barbecue party and said, I'm not afraid of you. You're a bully. And what's going to happen to you is I will bring you to your knees. You will end up in jail, and I will not. I have more power than you. You are nothing more than a mob boss. These are things you don't want to do. Start threatening mob bosses because they will have you killed or tortured or both. First, they might torture you. Then they will kill you. And there are bad things that could be happening to this chick, even though I've told you she's super hot. But she has no interest in men, which is a problem. So she's taking on the mob, and I'm not sure if I'm on her side or the mob side. I don't think this is going to end well for the mob because, you know, in the end, my guess will be that they get rubbed out. But the interim, where I have to put up with whether or not they're going to survive and bring her to her knees, could be fun because they are going to do whatever it takes to ruin her life, which is kick ass. So then they start having problems at the games as the mob and hooligans start taking on the chick and her cops. They've hired 20 new cops and 20 soldiers. So they have the military there and they have cops. They have riot gear. They have hoses that they're shooting on the fans. And they tell them they're no longer allowed to come in without a ticket because they used to get in without a ticket to the games. And they went in because everyone feared them. And now the cops are saying no one gets in without a ticket. And if you don't like it, you're not getting in. We don't care what you think. And we'll arrest you. And then they start arguing with them. So they turn the hoses on them and peppering them with water 100 miles an hour. And they will not let them in with their banners because the chick in charge of security says the banners hide them from seeing thefts and shankings and shootings. Imagine going to a soccer game in Argentina and any of that happens to you. You get shot or shanked or beaten or robbed. Sounds like a great day at the stadium, huh? So now when they go to the games, it's a war happening at the gate. They can't even get into the stadium without violence breaking out on the streets around the decrepit old stadium. And the show is getting more kick-ass by the episode. I'm 3 episodes in, and I love the violence.
Want to be the next Daily Fantasy Millionaire? Dunk on your NBA DFS competition with DailyRoto.com and dominate on FanDuel and DraftKings this season. Compete with the pros with DailyRoto.com, Optimizer, and the most accurate projections in NBA DFS, plus lineup alerts, breaking news, late swap support, and much more. Save 10% on winning NBA DFS advice with promo code DUNK. Visit DailyRoto.com/DUNK to learn more.
Things started getting real interesting when the top cop that works for the chick that's in charge of security went down to the mob's headquarters and broke into their drug command post where they make all their money and drugs. And he beat up the women that were running it and counting the drug money. And he punched one of the chicks in the face. And then they screwed up their whole operation and shut him down. And so the hooligans and the mob got really mad. And then they went and got revenge by tracking down the cop down by the pier when he was fishing with his buddy, and they shot him. He fell into the ocean. Everybody thought he was dead, but no, he lived. His friend saved him and got him to the hospital. And the chick said she was going to make him pay for this. But in the meantime, the mob boss's player that he brought in finally got his chance to play in a match when they took one of the top players on the team and held him captive in a garage. And so the kid, Gabriel, finally got to play in his first game with the club. He scored a goal and the fans went crazy. Meanwhile, the mob boss took the young kid in that's the driver for his henchmen. And he took him to his first game ever. The kid could never go to a game because he didn't have any money. He was poor and never had a chance to go to the stadium. But he got to go with the mob boss. And he saw the mob boss's player, Gabriel, score the goal. And he was drinking beer. And everyone was happy. Things were really hitting a wall on the show. I was about to lose it until I finally saw the mob boss's young player, Gabriel, who wants to hit on the mob boss's daughter and take care of that piece and get a little leg. And he finally did it as they were all out at a nightclub and her friends were doing ecstasy. And then she got him to do ecstasy. He might fail a drug test. Who knows? But in the moment, everything got hot and spicy. And then they did it, of course, in the chick's bathroom. What a great first date for both of them. Meanwhile, Lomito, the mob boss, is running for president. We got trouble brewing in paradise as the young kid who's the driver for the henchman, Fabian, the young kid Mario, whose best friend Rafa got him the job, and then he basically stole his job because Rafa had been shot and Rafa was healing and Mario took his gig. And then when Rafa healed, he didn't get his gig back because Fabian liked Mario too much. So Rafa maintained his gig as nothing more than a bag man picking up money for their drug deals. He's very jealous of Mario. And now he wants revenge. And he started stalking him and threatening him in front of his hot little girlfriend. Meanwhile, Mario's been running errands with the henchmen. He's been involved in crimes. He's held guns to people's head. They've extorted money. He's been with them as they went to people that were enemies of the hooligans. And Fabian beat the crap out of these people that they didn't like. And meanwhile, the kid Mario was involved in all of it. He keeps lying to his girlfriend and saying he never does anything wrong. And this kid Rafa is going to try to bring him down. He threatened his family. He said, I know where you live, so I'm going to get you. And all of this violence is coming to a head. So the jealous kid Rafa broke into Mario's girlfriend's apartment. And then he attacked her in her shower and beat her to a pulp. She wouldn't tell Mario who did it, but when she went to the doctor and hospital to get checked out, she said she's going to be fine, she's going to recover, but that she was pregnant, and it looks like Mario knocked up his girlfriend, and then she finally told him the truth that Rafa did it, so he went, found Rafa, and beat the living crap out of him, punched him in the face 100 times, kicked him in the onions, kicked him in the face, kicked him in the skull, stomped on him, and left him for dead, and it was awesome. In an unbelievable development, Mario is shot in the back dead. He tried to go follow one of the other bad guys back to the rail yard where they were selling drugs, but he didn't go with Fabian. He went by himself, and they caught him. Now it's the final episode, and Mario is dead, and his pregnant girlfriend will be left with a baby that's fatherless. Fabian has been blamed, and of course, his boss, Lomito, will also be blamed. He's been blamed for everything. The lady in charge of all the team security blames him for everything, and it's been a war the entire series between Lomito and the chick in charge of security. She's gotten everybody else fired. She's working with the rogue cop. It's chaos, and now we've got a dead body. Finally, someone on the mob side has been killed, and all hell has broken loose. What is going to happen in the final episode? There's so much pressure. Of course, the head of security, Diana, her girlfriend ready to leave her, and their affair looks like it's coming to an end because she's been so self-absorbed with trying to bring down the mobster. It's going to cost her everything and everyone she knows, her job, her career, her lover. And will the mob end up having to kill her because she's been in the way the whole series? So the guys that killed Mario is like the bad guys that are up against Lomito. So Lomito lets him sell drugs up till the rail yard and nothing passed in his neighborhood and he gets a 10% cut. They've broken all the rules. It's Octopus and Sosa. Octopus was the guy that shot Mario. And Lomito does not know yet that young Mario has been shot dead in the back running away from Octopus and Sosa. And the entire series, Lomito does not trust Sosa and he hates Octopus and so does Fabian. All hell is going to break loose. So finally, Fabian tells Lomito that Octopus and Sosa and the gypsy were involved in killing Mario. Lomito says, we're going to do some research and find out exactly what happened. But Fabian knows it was them. And he says to Lomito, you're not going to do anything about it? I thought you were our friend, our family. We look up to you, and this is all you're going to do for me after my boy Mario gets shot in the back dead? That's all you're going to do for me? How pathetic is that? I think Fabian's going to handle this mess on his own and get revenge for the death of his boy Mario. Someone has to pay the price. So what happens to Diana? All of a sudden, she gets beat up by young thugs in the neighborhood. This little boy Ernesto, who she was taking care of, he set her up. She goes to the hospital to get fixed and does not narc out Ernesto. She tells the police that two adults did it, and it was too dark to see who they were, so she wouldn't blame the little punk-ass kids. So Fabian decides to handle things his own way. He goes over to the auto dealership where Gypsy works, one of Octopus and Sosa's boys, and he puts 6 rounds into his chest. That's the end of Gypsy as we now know him. Meanwhile, Lomito's having a Presidente party at the football club with all of his followers and fans and everyone cheering. Meanwhile, Diana is about to arrest Lomito with the cops and bring him down. It appears that Diana is working with the cop to put a couple of kilos of blow inside Lomito's truck so that when he leaves his little party at the football club, they're going to find his truck filled with blow. Also, one of his henchmen knows now that Lomito's daughter is banging the soccer star that's living in Lomito's crib. He's got another pad that his wife used to use. That's where the kid's been living and sleeping with Lomito's daughter, but the henchman followed her there and watched her do him all night and then went in and confronted the soccer player. So the soccer player is busted. And when Lomito finds out through his henchman that his daughter's banging a soccer player, Lomito's going to kill the kid. Now here's Lomito getting at a police stop. They're going to pinch him and find the drugs. And he is absolutely screwed. Of course, he's been busted, and now he's saying, somebody planted that in my truck, and he's calling him Mother Forellers, and he's blaming Sosa and Octopus, and now Lomito's pinched, and he's livid. Meanwhile, across town, Octopus is unloading soccer shoes. The only problem is the soles of the soccer shoes are filled with kilos of blow that they're shipping in and selling in the neighborhood. They are evil people. It's a beautiful thing. But here comes Fabian doing 100 miles an hour to drive into them and kill them all. It's going to be a war, tires screeching, guns firing, everyone's blazing, shotguns, semi-automatic rifles, machine guns, massive gunfire, bodies dropping, Octopus in trouble, Fabian trying to kill all of them, Fabian trying to kill Octopus. He's got a 12-gauge. He's blasting off rounds. He got hit in the knee. Unbelievable. Fabian goes down, but he hits Octopus. He got him with a shot of the 12-gauge. Looks like Octopus is going to die. He got one to the chest. Fabian, though, is on the ground in massive pain. It looks like he got shot in the legs. Octopus is dying. He's not going to last. Fabian might get out of this, though. He's still moving. Octopus down to his last breaths, trying to get up. He's not going to make it. Here's Fabian. One last move. Octopus trying to fire off a round on the ground. He has less than 10 seconds to live. One last shot, though. Fabian on the ground with the 12-gauge nails. Octopus again, and he's dead, and Fabian wins the battle, but collapses himself, but he's still alive. Looks like the charges are going to stick against Lomito. He's facing 4 years for the drugs in his truck, and he will not be the president of the club. He's going to lose everything, and it looks like Diana's going to win in the end. After all, she says happy endings are for real. Everyone loves a happy ending, Jagadu. Finally, Diana confronts Guillermo, the chairman of the football club, and knows that he paid off a judge to drop the case against Lomito so that Diana would lose and Lomito would win and become the president. So she knows that her boss has been corrupt the entire time and she's had about enough of his BS. She called him a coward and said he has no balls, which is a beautiful line. And now she's telling him that he will not continue as the chairman of the football club. Instead, you will support me as your successor. I'm taking over the team entirely. This is what my grandfather would have wanted. And you're a lying fat loser and a traitor and a backstabber. So there you have it. Diana takes over the club. The chairman leaves disgraced, a complete loser. And now it ends, and the ratings come in. At the end of the day, Puerta 7 ended up sucking ass. It was boring. I wanted to kill myself. I thought it was good in the beginning, the first couple of episodes, a lot of violence, murders, beheadings, and beatings. But then through the middle, like 4, 5, and 6 were a complete disaster of nothingness and a waste of time. 7 was lame. 8, they picked it up a little bit, and everybody ended up getting busted in the end or losing their jobs or getting killed. Lamely, like Mario getting shot in the back. The young kid had a long life in front of him, and instead he leaves his girlfriend pregnant and fatherless, her child. And she ends up taking over the club, Diana, and the chairman leaves disgraced, and Fabian ends up shooting Octopus. The whole thing was atrocious. I hated it, but I hope you enjoyed another exciting adventure of Pharrell on Netflix with another crappy, violent series that I had to get enough of that I could have done without. Check it out.
Are you ready for the nation's first and only free 24-hour network dedicated to you, the betting and fantasy sports enthusiast? SportsGrid will provide you with real-time content, statistics, and gaming intelligence unlike anything you've ever seen before. Located both in the heart of New York City and inside the FanDuel Sportsbook at the Meadowlands, SportsGrid is live 18 hours a day, here to serve you, the fanatic. This is SportsGrid. Get on the grid.
Ever wondered how a book gets made into a movie?
Or how to master the art of cooking?
Either way, we've got you covered with the Two Guys from Hollywood podcast. I'm Alan Nevins, a literary agent and talent manager.
And I'm Joey Santos, a columnist and celebrity chef.
On our podcast, we're going to be serving you a fresh perspective of the entertainment industry alongside our favorite celebrity guests.
As we like to say, we don't dish, we serve.
Listen and follow Two Guys from Hollywood on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll talk at you soon.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.